This is Bob Morris in Desert Horticulture. Today I want to talk to you about the summer heat. It was a brutally hot summer this past year. A lot of plants turned brown. Was heat the only reason why? All this and more on today's Desert Horticulture. According to a lot of people in the Las Vegas Valley and elsewhere around the Mojave Desert, it was an awful, brutal summer this past year. Why? Because the temperatures were up higher than we're used to and for longer periods of time. And also the nighttime temperatures never seemed to cool off. We saw a lot of plants turning brown around town. Did they turn brown because of the heat? Maybe, maybe not. Let's talk about it. High temperatures can do damage to plants, but what's more damaging to plants is if they don't get enough water. I maintain the number one reason that existing plants, landscape plants, were turning brown in home landscapes was because of a lack of water. So let's talk about water for just a little bit. And there may be some other reasons in there, and there are other reasons. Besides water, we can talk about diseases that might have popped up. We can talk about re-landscaping an area, taking the grass out and around an existing tree or shrub and having that tree die. We can talk about exposure, landscape exposure. I know of one instance in a home landscape where some installations were done on some plant materials, and the person who did the design work maintains that the plants were then pruned, and that exposed more light and more damage to the plants. What about soil mixes? In order to get plants healthy, you have to give them a soil that they can grow in, that their roots can penetrate, their roots can stay comfortable. Their roots, comfortable is a bad word to use around plants because that's more of an animal trait. The landscape plants do grow roots into soils, and if the soil is too wet, if there's not enough oxygen, that can cause plants some problems on plants. If the surface of the soil, let's say for instance, we'll get into it a little bit more, but let's say for instance the roots are growing near the surface for whatever reason. Maybe the soil is not improved, maybe there's light frequent irrigations that are happening on a daily basis, it encourages shallow root development. And also there's some pruning problems that go along as well. If we have a landscape pruner, a landscape maintenance company that prunes inappropriately around plants, that can also cause a problem. We'll talk about all of these but first I want to mention water. The number one reason why plants, existing plants in landscapes, turn brown is because of a lack of water. They just turn brown because the watering wasn't done right. Let's cover the basics on landscape watering. So if you've got, for instance, I went by some pine trees off of one street that's located near the university, and the whole row of pine trees, you could tell that they didn't get enough water, that they turned back the irrigation for whatever reason in that particular area, and they just weren't getting enough water. But if we have a tree, if we have a landscape plant, and it's getting larger, it's going to require more water in order for it to stay healthy, in order to survive the landscape. If we've had also a lot of wind, remember, when we're talking about water use in plants, we're really talking about four major factors that can control plant water use. One is the intensity of the solar radiation. Now, is in places like the Las Vegas Valley, the Mojave Desert area, we have a certain number of cloudless days per year, and it's pretty high, where there's no cloud. So I think in the summertime, you can assume that solar intensity, the intensity of a sunlight, is going to be pretty consistent from day to day if it's a cloudless day. If there are clouds in the sky, then, yeah, there can be some differences in the amount of sunlight. It's almost like throwing up a shade cloth over the plant materials, over the landscape. So there's also solar intensity. There is the temperature that's produced, and that's different than intensity of sunlight. Intensity of sunlight is one thing, but the temperature. We can have a winter day that's pretty warm out. So the solar intensity in the wintertime, because the sun is at a different angle, isn't as great as it is in the summer months, but it can still be fairly warm. That's what's pretty unique about the desert climates. So we can have a fairly high light intensity. We can have a fairly warm day when the light intensity is fairly low during the winter months and still have significant amounts of water being used by plants. Now let's talk about wind. If we're going to focus on one thing that changes from day to day, and that's wind. When we get up in the morning and we go outside and we're figuring on weather, because we should be thinking about what we need to do to our landscape. But one thing that really, that you can do yourself a favor about, a favor with, and that is when you walk outside, you look at, is it a bright sunny day? Is it going to be a warm day today? You can download some weather apps to tell you that. Is it going to be windy today? If there is going to be strong winds, we better turn the irrigation system on, even if it's not scheduled to come on for another day. We probably need to put that irrigation system on. The last thing I want to talk about is the humidity, the relative humidity. In the desert, we can have very consistently, when it hasn't been raining, 10, 15%, maybe 20% humidity. Whereas in the tropics, we might be looking at a rainless day at 60, 70, 80% humidity. When it's raining, it's close to 100%. Even in the desert, when it's raining, the humidity is up because of the evaporation from the soil of that rainwater out into the... So it's going to be pretty high. But if we've been in a stretch, like we've had in the last several months, a stretch of time when there has been no rain, where plants really are being stressed now, where we've had a lot of wind. So when you're walking outside, you want to look at, is the sky cloudless? Is it going to be a high light intensity day today? Is it in the summertime? What are the temperatures going to be like? Are they going to be high? But more importantly than that, I think, you know, when you look at temperatures, you know pretty much whether they're going to be lower temperatures in the wintertime or higher temperatures in the summertime. You might be able to skip a day of irrigation. If you're really, really careful, you might be able to skip a day of irrigation here and there when there's cloud covering or when the temperatures are lower than predicted. But temperatures are pretty consistent from season to season. In the wintertime, there's lower temperatures, and then in the summertime, there's higher temperatures. But that wind speed, that's the kicker. That's the one that really can throw us off, because wind and solar radiation probably are the two most influential of those four requirements that I told you. What are they? They're solar radiation, they're temperature, humidity, and wind. Of those four, solar intensity is probably going to be more influential than temperature and humidity. But wind is that kicker. So if you look at the two of them, the solar radiation, how intense, whether it's a cloudless day or night or not, and the wind speed are going to be the two factors of those four that are going to be really driving plant water use. Temperature is pretty consistent from month to month, season to season. Solar radiation also is consistent from season to season. Wintertime, summertime, spring, and fall. But the one kicker that's in there, even the humidity can be somewhat the same. Now, you can change the humidity by having a lawn, for instance, or by having a water feature that sprays water into the air. You can bump the humidity up. And if you get up high enough, it might influence some of the harder to set fruit trees, for instance, like Hychia persimmon, and some of the sweet cherries. You might have a higher, you know, If you're looking at humidity, something that's really not talked about very much, and that is the role of humidity in fruit production. When you're in a desert climate, if the humidity is too low, it will affect, it'll lower the pollination of some fruit trees. It'll lower the ability of that, of those trees to set fruit if the humidity is too low, whatever the reason, whether it's because of the pollen, because of the sperm count, whatever it might be, there is a reason why low humidity will have an impact on some, on fruit production of some fruit trees. And that magic number is right around 30%. And if we can bump the humidity up just a little bit by having a pool, by having a lawn, by having a water feature that spews water up in the air, if we can bump that humidity up, we're going to get some plants to set fruit that might not normally set if they're in a dry climate. But that's not here nor there. We're talking about brown plants and why they turn brown this summer. And water, I maintain, is probably the first one. We can also have a problem on established plants. When we go out, and let's say, for instance, these established plants were growing in a landscape and surrounded by lawn, by turf grass. And now we're tempted by that $3 or $4 per square foot rebate that we can get from a local water purveyor, and ripping out that grass and saving that money. But in the same, if that tree is established under a lawn, its roots are everywhere in that lawn. It's just like it was receiving water from everywhere. And now what you're doing is you're taking that lawn away, those sprinklers that were throwing water on that lawn and providing water to all those roots. And now we're removing that lawn and probably replacing it with some drip emitters in places where the tree is not, or shrubs are not really used to taking up water. And so it's going to take a little bit of time for them to adjust to that. In the meantime, those areas that aren't getting water, where the roots were, you figure the size of a root system of an established tree to be about twice as its, of its height. In other words, you can take a tree or a large shrub, lay it on its side, and spin a, if it's being irrigated by lawns, and spin a circle with it, and you can roughly describe where those roots are going to be located. Wherever there's water, roots are going to grow. On the contrary side of that, if we establish plants on drip irrigation and we keep those drip emitters close to that plant, those roots start developing where the water is. If it's surrounded by a lawn, the roots are twice the height of that tree or shrub. If the bubblers, if the drip emitters are being used around that tree, then the roots are going to be where the water is located, water and fertilizer primarily. So that's where they're going to be. Now you take that lawn out, and I can just look right over close to me, close to where I live. I drove by an area and I saw probably it was a fairly young ash tree. The ash tree was probably 20 feet tall, 20, 25 feet tall, fairly young yet. It was probably Modesto. I really couldn't tell at that distance, but one of the ash trees. And it was totally brown. I drove by it in September. And I looked, as I drove by it, there was a wall. But as I passed by the wall, I kind of looked behind it. And I could see that rock was surrounding that tree. And my guess is that tree was formerly in lawn. And when it was being irrigated by a lawn, the roots were everywhere. What? Twice the height of the tree. So those roots were probably growing in a diameter, if it was totally surrounded by lawn, of perhaps 40 feet in diameter. Now let's say you go ahead and take that lawn out that it was growing under, it was being irrigated from, and now you take the lawn out and you replace it with 4, 5, 6 drip emitters located maybe 12, 18, 24 inches away from the tree in that general area. Generally speaking, you can remove about half of a functional root system of a tree or a shrub before you're going to start seeing an impact on the tree or shrub in its growth. You can remove about half of it and still feel comfortable if that half represents half of the functional root system that was growing out there. But if you go more than that, if you go more than 50%, you're going to see some problems starting to develop. And my guess is that that tree, that ash tree, probably was, the lawn was taken out and drip emitters were put in and it turned brown. Because the roots, when it's above ground, who knows where the roots are when it's in a lawn system. So you're just guessing when you're putting down drip emitters. You're guessing that the roots are going to be there. They would have been smarter if they had gone through and root pruned that tree, that ash tree. In other words, gone in and maybe cut those roots to half of their size. So maybe let's say the roots were growing out 20 feet in radius from the trunk 20 feet out. Let's say you go out 8 or 10 feet from that tree and you just start cutting roots. Because if they are being irrigated by a lawn, the roots are going to be fairly shallow because that's where the water is being applied. And if you're overwatering a lawn, then it's going to be wet below that. But roots are going to grow where there's a good mixture of air and water and fertilizer. Where is that? In a lawn? If roots are growing with a lawn, they're going to be in that upper 12 inches, probably. The majority of the roots are going to be in the upper 12 inches of that soil. That's where the fertilizer is located. Grass is extremely efficient. Grasses are really good at taking up fertilizers, especially nitrogen fertilizer. Really, really good, to the point where they can stress out woody plants and just rob them, just take that nitrogen right away from them, that fertilizer. So you put down a 21-7-14 for the lawn, let's say, and that nitrogen fertilizer, that 21% that you put down, the lawn is going to just gobble it right up. Very little of it is going to get through to the trees. We're not here to talk about deep root fertilizing trees. That's another subject. But basically keep that in mind. So the fertilizer, the water, when the water is applied to the lawn, how deeply do you water a lawn? About 8, 10, 12 inches deep. You can take a piece of rebar and figure that out, but that's generally where the water is going to be thrown out by sprinklers. So where are the roots going to grow of an ash tree that was formerly grown in a lawn? The vast majority are going to be in the upper 12 inches of that soil, which means then you should be able to go through with a pretty sharp shovel and about 8 to 10 feet away from that trunk and just slice those roots before you start putting the drip emitters on. Then those roots that are beyond that area are no longer, they're cut off, they're going to die. You're going to see mushrooms starting to develop if it's wet in those areas. After a rain, for instance, you're going to see mushrooms start because the roots have died. It's wood and they're going to rot. But if you cut 8 to 10 inches with a sharp shovel down as deep as you can before you put the emitters, that plant is, before you put the drip emitters in, and you're shifting again, you're shifting it away from a lawn irrigation into drip irrigation, you're going to have a better chance. If you could go a little closer, and I can't tell you how close you can get to that tree. Maybe you can get 6 feet away from that tree and cut those roots. Maybe 5 feet. I wouldn't go much closer than that and cut those roots. And maybe when roots are cut, they grow differently than the top of a plant. The top of a plant grows, has a certain form or structure depending upon where the buds are located. Roots don't. When you cut a root, most of the roots, if they're getting water and air, they're going to grow from just below where you cut. And most of those roots are going to take off from there. But if the water is being applied close to the trunk, if that water is being applied from drip emitters now that are closer to the tree and not way out from the lawn, then chances are you're going to develop a better root system if it's cool in the air. And the better time to do that would be in the fall, right around now, right around late September, October, when temperatures are starting to cool off. Go ahead and cut those roots of those trees. Go ahead and put your drip emitters in and really encourage. You can do that with an application of fertilizer, high phosphorus fertilizer, like a 16-20-0, for instance, or anything else that has high phosphorus content. The middle number is that high phosphorus. A rose fertilizer, for instance. Rose fertilizers, fruit tree fertilizers, typically are higher in phosphorus than lawn fertilizers, for instance. So anything that encourages flowering and fruiting encourages also root development as well. So that middle number is that phosphorus number, and that's the one that you're really going to concentrate on. That's going to be important. So you go ahead and cut those roots, and you make your fertilizer applications where you're going to apply water. And the first few times that I watered, I'd water close to where those drip emitters are located. I'd water it fairly deep as that rock is being put on top of that area, or hopefully not rock. If it's an ash, you're going to be using hopefully wood chips more than rock. But there are a lot of people that will go ahead and put rock in because that's the thing to do. Heck, if you're doing desert landscaping, even if you're not using desert plants, you should use rock. No, I'm just joking. But that's the whole concept. No, if you're not putting desert plants in and you're not putting in desert landscaping, then why use rock? But anyway, and rock, you know, with the surface temperature, I took an infrared gun. And I held it at 90, the air temperature was 95 degrees in the spring. And I took the surface temperature with one of those little guns in multiple locations. And I did it on a sidewalk, I did it on a rock landscape, and I did it on asphalt, just to see if there was a difference. They were all about the same. Guess what the temperature was? 167 degrees. 95 degrees air temperature. Relatively low humidity, but on all three of those surfaces, there were some slight differences. One, as are my memory, 165-ish to 175-ish in that general range. But when that air temperature and full sunlight hit 95 degrees, it put out a lot of heat, a lot hotter than you'd want to touch it, that's for sure. 165, 170 degrees, that's pretty doggone hot. But anyway, so that's the reason why. And if you were to throw water on it, it's going to drop the temperature down in our desert climate up for about maybe 15 or 20 minutes, and then it's going to go right back up again because the humidity is so low and our light intensity is so high and everything else. You know, when you apply water, the cooling effect from water only lasts for a short period of time in the desert. It lasts a lot longer when you have higher humidity. But when you have low humidity, 15-20% humidity, and you've got wind on top of that, it's a perfect scenario. Remember what I told you about those four things that are important for plant water use? Remember I told you those four things. What are they? Sunlight, solar light intensity, humidity, temperature, and wind. All those four factors. Of those four factors, the two that are most important for you when you're determining water use of plants is going to be solar radiation, believe it or not, more powerful than temperature, and also wind. What is the least stable from day to day? Wind. So when you walk outside and you're estimating whether it's time to turn on the controller, if it's windy, you better turn the water on. You better turn the water on and give those plants a drink before it gets hot. Because otherwise, if you don't, all it's going to take in our environment for those leaves to turn brown is just a couple of hours. If they're water stressed, and now we're getting back to the brown plants in the landscape, if they're water stressed, and we have a lot of wind, if you don't turn your irrigation system on, shame on you. Because remember those four factors that drive plant water use. They're very, very important. And you can be a good water steward just by paying attention. By paying attention to what's going on around you. What's the wind like? And of those factors, the wind in during the summer months is very critical. And what happened this last summer? We had high winds in at least one or two locations. I wasn't here. I was out of the country. But I heard in at least one day, if not 2 days, we had pretty high. You look at wind speeds that are getting up around 15, 20 miles per hour. You're looking at some high water use times. A tree is sticking up out of the ground. It's got a whole bunch of branches coming out of it with the leaves attached to it, and the wind goes right through it. What's that wind going to do? What's that wind going to do as opposed to a lawn that's a flat surface, a two-dimensional surface? Yeah, the wind goes over the... And as you get higher in elevation, as you get increase in elevation, wind speed increases. As it gets closer to the ground, wind speed decreases. So on that lawn area, the wind speed decreases. It's a two-dimensional plane. So the water use, even though it's pretty high, when I walk over a lawn area, I figure that if it's a fescue, for instance, which is 95% of our lawns in the Las Vegas area, of a cool season grass, in the Las Vegas area, 95% of those lawns are probably a fine fescue of some sort, tall fescue. If you look at the water use of that lawn for the whole year, and you stick your hand up as high as you can reach, 7 feet in the air, 7.5 feet in the air, that's going to represent how much water that lawn is going to use. Now, if you get under a tree, and if it's a desert tree, you're probably going to use somewhere around 2 feet of water distributed under the canopy of that tree. If you're looking at a moderately high water user, like the ash trees, for instance, that I mentioned before, you're looking at around 4.5 feet of water, a column of water sitting under that canopy of that tree, 4.5 to 5 feet deep. If you're looking at a really high water use tree, like mulberries, for instance, how do you know? Because it has rapid growth, it has big leaves, big leaf surfaces. If wind can move through it, then it's going to take that hot, dry air in the summertime and just push it right through the leaves. And as it moves across the leaves, it sucks up the water. Just like a dry sponge, it sucks it up. But you're going to be looking at around 6 feet of water that you're going to need for the whole year under high water use trees and shrubs. So this isn't a class about landscape design and water use, but let's keep it in mind. So what am I talking about? Why am I talking? I'm already up to 28 minutes on this thing and I'm not even done yet. What am I talking? I am saying that download an app on your phone. Get one that tells you what the weather is going to be like. AccuWeather, NOAA has one. Several places have them. Look at them and download it so that you can look ahead into what that next week is going to be like in terms of wind speed, in terms of temperature, because that's all it's going to tell. It's not going to tell you solar radiation. You're just going to figure that's going to be pretty consistent. So, bottom line is, I think that we just don't think about our plants enough. When we get up and we walk outside, we should be paying attention. How bright is it? Is it a warm day today? What's the wind like today? Figure the humidity. What can you do to raise the humidity in an area? What if you've got sour cherries, sweet cherries, and they're not productive? They're flowering, but they're not producing any fruit. Hychia persimmon, what can you do? Put in a lawn. Put in a swimming pool. Put in a fountain that spews water up in the air. Anything, especially have it running during times of flowering and bee activity, so that humidity goes up and that it has a better chance of getting fruit set on it. What other reasons can plants turn brown? Well, one of them is if they're fairly new plants, or if you've done something new in the landscape, such as pruning. If your light intensity changes on plants, like star jasmine, for instance, it does really nicely. It's that flowering plant that you see white flowers, really gorgeous smell that it can have. I love it near a window that you can open and have that smell come inside your home in the evening. I don't like them far away from the home because that smell is lost, but close to the home, it's a great place. But put it on the east side of a home where it gets some reprieve from some afternoon sunlight. Don't put it in the south or western exposure. Or if you've got it under a tree and you've suddenly pruned it and take away the shade that it was enjoying before and now it scorches, now you've got a brown plant before you didn't. And you're scratching your head going, I wonder what happened. I wonder why it did that. Well, it may be that something had changed. Maybe you put that plant in to a hot, bright environment when it's not supposed to be in a hot, bright environment. Star jasmine is not, by the way, is not supposed to be surrounded by rock. It doesn't like it. Doesn't like it at all. It likes richer soils than that. It comes from areas where there are richer soils. So we've got to feed them those richer soils. Star jasmine, plants like that. So you've got to find good locations for it. Otherwise, go to desert plants. There's plenty of desert plants that you can pick from on it. Diseases also occur in landscapes sometimes. I want to go back to that ash tree. There's a disease that's overlooked quite often. I talk about it quite a bit on my blog. I talk about it in the newspaper article. And it's called ash decline. And anything that's got, they think, the scientists that have studied this think that if your ash tree has some genetics in it that bring it back to a certain type of ash, the Arizona ash, and most of our good ash trees for landscapes have those in it, such as Raywood ash, such as Modesto ash. They will have that genetics in it that will allow it to get a disease called ash decline. It's called in Arizona. And it's, what's it called in California? They put it a different name. I wish these scientists would get together and decide on a name. But it's called something else. It's ash something. I forget what it's called. I call it ash decline because that really is pretty descriptive of the whole thing. And there's a plant pathologist out of Arizona who did a good job of tracking some of that down. And there's been some discussion on Raywood ash in particular and the spread of this disease on it. So diseases can play an important part in turning plants brown. And you know, just like us, just like animals, other animals that are out there, the healthier we are, the more resistant we are to stresses. And environmental stress, like high light intensity, like drought, plants are going to be much more resilient if they're healthy than if they're not healthy. That makes a lot of sense, right? Well, then let's translate that into doing something in the landscape. Those plants that, like the ash trees, like almost all of the ash trees, like soils that are richer. They don't like to be put in rock. Raywood ash doesn't like to be surrounded by rock. Star jasmine doesn't like to be surrounded by rock. Roses don't like to be surrounded by rock. We do it. Japanese blueberry doesn't like to be surrounded by rock. Carolina cherry laurel, another one, doesn't like rock, surrounded by rock, and doesn't do well. Those plants come, as I like to joke, come from the great deserts of Japan and Carolinas, and it's a joke, but actually I've had a couple people believe me that there were deserts there. There is a small desert in Japan, but nothing really that we would gather plants out of. We take them from plants that are resilient, that can handle the heat, but they also expect to have a little bit better soil than they're going to get in the desert, a little bit better soil than they're going to get by soils that are brought into a landscape development into a development where they artificially make these soils with no organics in them at all. And this is something else. There's a difference between the organics. There's a difference in quality. Organics just aren't organics. There are some that are richer than others. Those that have been composted, for instance, are richer. And the type of composting is important. The garbage in, garbage out. Have you heard that phrase? Well, it holds true in compost too. You put, well, to a lesser degree, but you put in really junk into a compost. You put in bad stuff into a compost. You're going to get bad stuff out. You put in nicer stuff into a compost. You're going to get nicer stuff out. Although compost, probably not the best, because compost really does take a lot of waste products that are really pretty. In other words, what I'm saying is if you take municipal solid waste, and there is a history of that, there's, by the way, if the quality of the municipal solid waste, if there's no problem with that, there's nothing wrong with the compost made from it. But if, for instance, let's say you put paint thinner into your municipal solid waste, into the municipal, it's not good. It's not. It won't make a decent compost. It'll probably kill all the microorganisms. It may compost, but it's going to compost poorly. So use a good quality material. I consult with a company called Virigro in North Las Vegas. I don't like to push names, but Virigro at least has a couple of pretty good composts that they manufacture. Go ahead, they're in North Las Vegas. Go ahead and look them up. But they're going to produce some composts that you're going to find are going to be acceptable for vegetable gardens. They're going to be acceptable for using them around your landscape. So just take a look at some of that stuff. I mentioned exposure. I mentioned disease. I mentioned re-landscaping. Just remember that soil drainage, the water drainage in a soil. Once you start covering a soil in rock, you're going to restrict in about 3 to 5 years the organics that was used when that plant was planted. And hopefully they put something in the soil and they dug the hole large enough. They didn't just dig it large enough for the roots of the plant. But hopefully they dug it. They gave it a pretty good... Oh, that gets me into another subject. I don't want to talk about that. But hopefully, anyway, when you start putting organics back in the soil and planting time, and you cover the soil with rock, it's going to use up those organics. And slowly, that soil underneath that rock is not going to drain as well over the second or third or fourth year. It's going to get waterlogged. You put on an irrigation and it's going to stay wet. Where are the roots going to grow? Where there's a mixture of air and water. It's going to be up towards the surface. What happens during the summer months if that surface temperature of that soil gets hot? Let's say you don't put anything down. Let's say that's the one nice thing about rock. At least the surface of the soil, if you just take that rock and you move, if it's thick enough, if you move some of that rock away, you'll feel the coolness below, in just a couple of inches below that rock. So make sure that your surface is cool enough. And those plants that don't come out of the deserts shouldn't be planted with rock around them. Instead, use stuff that decomposes, that'll rot. Wood chips, not bark chips, but wood chips would be a better choice. So, and the last thing I want to talk about here as we're moving up here is pruning. I've said this before to people who want to take over their landscapes. The one problem area I see over and over again is trusting landscape companies that are mow and blow kind of landscape companies, trusting them to do pruning. Oh, don't do it. Because if they get a hold of your tree, all it takes is just one of them just doing it a bad job one time, and that tree is ruined. It will take, if it can recover at all, it'll take years. So get a decent pruning company, a certified arborist, for instance. Mom and pop certified arborists are better than corporate certified arborists, generally speaking. But make sure that you get somebody that knows what they're doing and you can trust them to do your pruning of your trees and large shrubs. Very, very important. If you want to maintain the aesthetics, if you want to maintain the value of those plants over the years. So what have I been talking about? I was talking about the heat, but I was talking about why things were turning brown. And just to recap in here, they turn brown for lots of different reasons, but I would still maintain that the number one reason during the heat of the summer, the reason they turn brown, typically is water. Probably secondarily is exposure, is landscape exposure. Were they planted on the right? Let's say they've been in the ground for 20 years and suddenly they turn brown. Was there some pruning that you didn't plan on? Maybe somebody came through and trimmed up your tree more than you wanted? Take a look at that. Because once you change that exposure in the desert, the landscape exposure, you change it into something that had from filtered light to something to that's bright light, especially during the heat of the summer, that can spell disaster on some plants if they're not prepared for it and if they're not healthy. How do you get plants healthy? Giving them a decent compost is one of it. Spread it around on the soil surface, rake it in as much as you can. When is a good time to do that? In the cool fall months is a great time to put that application down. And then cover it with wood chips. You can get wood chips free from the University Orchard in North Las Vegas over off of North Decatur, 100 yards east of North Decatur and Horse Drive up in the Aliante area in Las Vegas area. You can go ahead and pick that up. I think that opens as early as 7 a.m. I've got it on my blog posted, and I'll talk about how to use my blog in one of these posts very shortly. But anyway, I think it's time for me to leave because I hear some music. So it was nice talking to you. Stay in touch, and I hope your brown plants turn green real soon. Bye-bye. Look for my blog, Extreme Horticulture of the Desert. That's Extreme Horticulture beginning with an X. Also look at my Facebook page, Extreme Horticulture, and follow me there.